Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, May 23rd. I'm Lisa Music, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, you already took enough land. Michelle Merrifield on the Great Redwood Trail. Cal Normal says marijuana rescheduling is symbolically important. And McGuire says new laws will fix fire insurance crisis. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. The challenges of getting and keeping wildfire insurance are at a crisis level, but during a recent town hall event, Senator Mike McGuire promised a legislative response. Daniel Mentz reports.
Senator Mike McGuire says state lawmakers will be laser-focused on solving the wildfire insurance crisis this year, which means making affordably priced coverage available and restoring insurance for those who've been non-renewed. Last week was Wildfire Preparation Week, and McGuire held a May 8th online town hall to mark it. But he said there were dozens upon dozens of submitted questions on a related topic, the state's fire insurance crisis. A mix of increased wildfire and inflation has led insurance companies to suspend or limit new business despite having increased their rates. Insurance companies are canceling and non-renewing policies. Homeowners can get coverage through the California Fair Plan, a group of insurers convened by the state to provide insurance which would otherwise be unavailable, but its coverage is basic and expensive. McGuire said there's a big push to change all that.
We are going to be laser focused on solving this crisis in the legislature this year. And here's what we know. Because of the mega fires that have been plaguing our community since 2015, when the Valley Fire first broke out in Lake County, we have seen this insurance crisis spread across the Golden State. And now we're seeing significant number of non-renewals in Central and Southern California. And we've been seeing it here in Northern California. I want to be crystal clear this evening. Simply raising homeowners' insurance rates by 20 to 40% isn't going to make a community, and it's not going to make a home more fire safe. There's much more that we have to do. And what we also know is raising rates isn't going to be a game changer when it comes to fire prevention.
McGuire said the goal is to get about 85% of the people on the FAIR plan off of it and onto conventional insurance policies. He said there's also resolve to create a path to insurance for those who've had policies canceled or non-renewed. State grants are available to homeowners and communities who want to harden against wildfire dangers. But McGuire said, quote, Californians who are doing the right thing aren't getting credit for it with their insurance companies. Strategies for changing that were discussed in this exchange between McGuire and his guest, Cal Fire Chief Joe Tyler.
Insurance companies are in the business of risk. If we're significantly reducing the risk of wildfire, they should write. There is no statute on the books right now that forces them to do so. And I will tell you, we have tried it, by the way. And again, Chief is not saying this. This is just my own belief, is that it gets incredibly political. They come in with a lot of money to be able to fight it. But I'm telling you, we're going to bring it back, because if we have home hardening dollars available and hardworking Californians are putting their own hard-earned dollars into making their communities more fire-safe, insurance companies should write. Chief, I gave my opinion. Take it away. You don't need to be as blunt as I was, but Chief, take it away on your thoughts on where Tom is talking.
That's all right. I'm right there with you, Senator. And, you know, really what it comes down to is continuing regardless of where we are in the insurance problem, it is about each of us helping each other protect our homes and our properties and the environment. So continuing that defensible space, getting involved in a fire safe council or becoming part of a FireWise community.
McGuire also said homeowners need to be able to easily access the fire risk scores insurance companies use to base policy decisions on. True to the theme for the week, the town hall also included lots of information on dealing with wildfire risk. In this exchange with McGuire, Tyler gave advice on measures like reducing spark-related fires when using maintenance equipment.
Take it away, Chief. What's the best way to make your property more fire safe by reducing fuel load?
So property is always different across the board, but in general, weed eating in the morning or in the evening when relative humidities are higher to get that vegetation down, mowing. Remember that your lawnmower is meant for a lawn, not necessarily a field. It does have the tendency to create a spark if it hits a tree, or I'm sorry, if it hits a rock or something of that nature. So just be cautious and make sure that you have a water supply nearby as you're doing that. Now, many fire safe councils have grants that provide chipping opportunities for chippers to come out and chip some of that larger debris. Remove the ladder fuels will really help reduce the fire load in your property.
More information on preparing for wildfires and reducing their risk is available on CAL FIRE's website at fire.ca.gov. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The Ill River Wailaki have announced their inaugural big-time event, a vibrant celebration of Native American cultures set to take place this weekend, May 25th and 26th, at the Southern Humboldt Community Park in Garberville. This free gathering will feature traditional workshops and traditional dances. Attendees can purchase food and handcrafted items from local artisans throughout the event. Saturday's activities kick off with an opening prayer at 11 a.m., followed by a day filled with traditional knowledge workshops and performances by notable speakers and musicians, including Goodshild Aguilar, Dr. Lila June, and Desiree Harp. Workshops will cover a variety of skills such as soapstone bead making, flint knapping, basket weaving, and more. Sunday's program will commence with a prayer at noon, followed by traditional dances and demonstrations. The event is family-friendly and accessible, with handicap parking and access available. Pets are not permitted, except for registered service dogs. For further details and the full schedule, visit the Facebook page Friends of the Eel River Wailakis, or contact the organizers via email at events@eelriverwailaki.com. When the federal government finishes reclassifying marijuana into Schedule 3 of the Federal Controlled Substances Act, important business tax breaks will become available to struggling California cultivators. Kelly Lincoln brings you this report.
KMUD News spoke with Dale Gehringer, director of Cal Normal, about the changes underway to the listing of marijuana under the United States Federal Controlled Substances Act. Marijuana was listed as a Schedule I narcotic in 1972 as a drug with a high probability for addiction and with no accepted medical uses. This year, the Biden administration moved to reclassify it under Schedule III as a drug with recognized medical uses and with a lower potential for abuse, and the FDA has agreed to this. Gehringer said Normal has always seen marijuana as a drug that should be treated like alcohol or cigarettes, which are not under the Federal Controlled Substances Act.
Normal believes that marijuana should be treated like alcohol and tobacco, basically, and taken out of the Controlled Substances Act. That's called descheduling, but descheduling can only be done by an act of Congress. And there is not a working majority in Congress to do something like that. So basically, this is the most that the Biden administration could do without congressional support was to reschedule under the Controlled Substances Act.
Meanwhile, moving forward with what is possible currently, Gehringer said,
so finally, over 50 years after the first rescheduling petition, this administration actually initiated its own measure to reschedule marijuana. And this time, the FDA and the DEA finally reversed their positions and announced that marijuana should be rescheduled.
Other drugs in Schedule 3 are mainly pain medications and various forms of amphetamines. Nonetheless, Gehringer explained why Cal Normal sees the current rescheduling as an important step forward.
We regard it as a step forward in the right direction that's more symbolic than anything else. But the symbolism is important. in the federal government, recognizing that it does have accepted medical use. And I think this will be beneficial to a lot of patients out there who would like to use marijuana, who's currently most doctors in the United States won't have anything to do with marijuana because it's a Schedule I drug, and that means it has no accepted medical use. But if it's changed to Schedule III, even symbolically, I think there will be a greater willingness on the part of doctors to talk about its use.
While Normal feels it may prove beneficial for patients to be able to talk to their doctors about marijuana, doctors will still not be able to write prescriptions under their medical license because Schedule III is highly regulated. This regulatory framework is likely to keep national corporations from becoming producers in the near term.
If I were a pharmaceutical company, I don't think I would spend time doing it, partly because you can't patent the drug, okay? You can't get a patent on the marijuana. So that really detracts from the profit potential for it. And partly because if you go through all of the regulatory hoops that are required for a Schedule III pharmaceutical, whatever you produce is going to be so expensive that it won't be able to compete with the state legal marijuana that's out there right now. So nobody's going to want to buy it.
However, the rescheduling of marijuana is likely to help with the federal taxation of current marijuana producers, according to Normal.
There is one, in my opinion, only one really major impact of the rescheduling on cannabis here in California, namely a tax penalty, especially called there's a 280E tax provision in the IRS code that forbids any marijuana business or any Schedule I or Schedule II illegal drug business from taking common business deductions for things like, you know, payroll and rent and utilities, all of these things that you could normally deduct from your business expenses when you pay your taxes. You can't do it for marijuana because marijuana is in Schedule I. If marijuana goes to Schedule III, that tax problem goes away, and that's a huge tax break for the industry. Operators that I've talked to say that tax penalty currently costs them maybe 15% of their total revenue.
Cal Normal still wants to see marijuana made normal under the law.
But we need descheduling, and that's not going to happen until we have a Congress that's willing to do it. And I wouldn't hold my breath. The great majority of California Congress people are on board with the idea of descheduling and legalizing at the federal level. And our senators, I think, are on board with that too. But you have to look to other states, especially senators of conservative states. Republican senators are a real problem at the moment. That's where the real anti-marijuana prohibitionist sentiment is at the moment.
This is Kelly Lincoln reporting for KMUD News.
The family of Shelley Mills is urgently seeking help to locate her after she went missing yesterday morning. Mills was last seen leaving her house at around 9:15 a.m. on May 22nd, heading to work in Eureka, but never arrived. Her daughter, Natasia Lake, has made a public plea for assistance, providing details about Mills' last known whereabouts and appearance. Mills was driving a gold champagne 2004 Chevy Silverado and wearing gray sweatpants, a gray hoodie with pink and teal, a dark pink ball cap, and bright pink shoes. Standing at approximately 5'3" tall and weighing 130 pounds, she has long dark hair. As her cell phone was left at home, tracking her location is challenging. The family has notified the Humboldt County Sheriff's Department, and anyone with information is urged to contact HCSO at 707-445-7251. Turning to Mendocino, KMED's Matt Lefevre brings the latest headlines from Mendocino County, where Ukiah gave the go-ahead to demolish a local landmark. A significant error led to the decertification of the county's ballot printer, and Hopland's roads are set for a makeover.
This is Matt Lefevre with the headlines out of Mendocino County for Thursday, May 23, 2024. Let's begin in Ukiah, where a significant decision has been made regarding a historic downtown building. The former Palace Hotel, long a subject of local concern, is now set for demolition. This follows a building permit issued by the City of Ukiah's chief building official, marking the end of a prolonged effort to either stabilize or demolish this structure. The fate of the Palace Hotel, a once grand establishment in Ukiah, has been uncertain for years. City officials have tried since 2011 to address the building's hazardous condition. In a city council meeting last November, the chief building official declared the hotel an imminent hazard to public safety. This prompted an order for the owner to apply for a permit to either stabilize or demolish the building by May 14th. In 2017, after failed attempts to work with private ownership, the city sought the appointment of a receiver to manage the property. That receiver, with financial assistance from local hotel owner G2 Ishwar, worked on plans to seismically retrofit the hotel. However, rising costs and the inability to secure further financing led to the termination of the receivership last year. Mr. Ishwar, having taken control of the property through foreclosure, agreed to sell it to a buyer with restoration intentions, but the sale fell through. With no progress made on addressing the building's dangerous state, the chief building official enforced a May 14th deadline for a demolition permit application. Mr. Ishwar complied, and the permit has been conditionally approved. Before demolition can begin, further steps, including securing a contractor and obtaining necessary permits, must be completed. City officials have publicly recognized the ties the community has to the building and its important place in Ukiah's history. However, city officials are concerned that it has been neglected for decades and has significantly deteriorated. While seismic retrofitting may be possible, their concern costs are prohibitive and finding investors has proven difficult. Looking forward, any new development on the site must adhere to downtown zoning codes, ensuring consistency with the vision for Ukiah's downtown core. There will be opportunities for public input during this pre-development process. Now turning to Mendocino County's elections, a ballot printing company made a significant error during the primary election has lost its certification. The Secretary of State revoked the certification of integrated voting systems, a decision that has sparked a legal dispute. The controversy centers around integrated voting systems, a ballot printing service that has been handling Mendocino County's elections for 15 years. Earlier this year, the company sent over 52,000 incorrectly printed ballots to voters for the March primary. The errors included sending Republican ballots to all registered voters in the county, regardless of their party affiliation. The mix-up led to multiple rounds of replacement ballots being sent out. In one case, voters like George McCord received 3 ballots, while others like Dolly Brown didn't get a correct replacement at all. The state's decision to decertify integrated voting systems was based on multiple violations. According to a letter from the Secretary of State, the company failed to notify state officials about the printing error within the required 2 business days. Additionally, they used an uncertified third-party vendor for adding ballot tints and watermarks, which contributed to the error. This is not the first time integrated voting systems has faced issues. Past elections in Colorado and Utah also saw errors that required significant fixes and manual recounts. Despite these past issues, Integrated Voting System CEO Eric Kozwalski disputes the recent revocation. In a letter from the company's legal counsel, they argue that Integrated did notify the Secretary of State within the required time frame and that the person responsible for the ballot tints was a contracted employee under their certification. The company has indicated it is preparing to litigate. Meanwhile, Mendocino County is moving forward seeking new vendors to ensure the integrity of future elections. Now let's turn to Hopland, where Caltrans is inviting the public to an in-person community meeting about the proposed Hopland ADA project. This meeting will take place on Wednesday, June 5th from 6 to 7 at the Chanel Valley Academy Multipurpose Room located at No. 1 Ralph Betcher Drive in Hopland. Caltrans staff will provide details and answer questions about the project, which aims to improve accessibility on US 101 in Hopland in Mendocino County. The proposed improvements include upgrading sidewalks, curb ramps, and driveways, as well as reconstructing the roadway and rehabilitating pavement. Community input is crucial to developing a construction plan that best serves Hopland, For more information, visit the Caltrans website at dot.ca.gov. And that's the latest from Mendocino County. I'm Matt LaFever in Hopland, reporting for KMUD News.
On Sunday, May 19th, Wailaki Tribal member Michelle Merrifield hosted a Kinistay Community Coalition meeting in the Southern Humboldt region to discuss Native opposition to the Great Redwood Trail. Serenity Wood brings you the details.
The Great Redwood Trail is a Rails to Trails project spearheaded by California State Senator Mike McGuire to convert the defunct North Coast Railway line into a 320-mile multi-use trail from San Francisco to Humboldt Bay. Supporters believe this trail, which would constitute one of the longest recreational trails in the country, would benefit the economies of Mendocino and Humboldt counties. But local Native people say that the planned trail, which passes through the rugged wilderness of the Eel River Canyon, hasn't adequately consulted with them or addressed their concerns about land access for Native people, tribal control of ancestral homelands, and sacred site protection. The Northwest Pacific Railroad was completed in October 1914. Its tracks were laid into the geologically unstable canyon along the Eel River Corridor, part of the ancestral homeland of the Kinistet people, which is what the Wailaki called themselves before first contact. Michelle Merrifield, a Wailaki tribal member who lives in Round Valley, rejects the trail from start to finish.
1910, 1915, this whole rail went along a lot of Native sites, Native territory. Bulldozed right through village sites, desecrated and decimated the lands, and those Natives were ran off their original territories where they were, the ocean, inland, that if you look at the maps, you can see, like, wow, there's a lot of tribal people or villages that had been there. Where are they? Where do they go? You know, and that saddens me because that's a fact that is no longer. That's what we hold on to. You know, that's our DNA. That's where we came from in that area with this trail. You know, it's not okay for that to happen through, you know, some of our ancient village sites. Mm-hmm. They're ancient burial sites. They're ancient ceremonial sites. That's part of our culture, our Native culture.
At a previous Kinistet Community Coalition meeting in Richardson's Grove, Trail Agency Representative Louisa Morris suggested placing colorful signage along the trail to educate hikers about the culturally sensitive sites surrounding them. Merrifield took offense to this idea.
But where this trail is coming through is kind of like exploiting all of that information. And, you know, putting it on signs, oh, these people lived here once upon a time, or back in this time, these tribal people were here. And, oh, look at this village sites. Oh, look at this petroglyphs. Or, you know, so it sounds like a tourist attraction, you know, for their trail.
In an earlier interview with Merrifield on April 10th in Round Valley, she deconstructed the Great Redwood Trail Agency's privilege in prioritizing outsider tourism above Native people.
They herded us out of that area into this valley. We're not able to go back up there. It's fenced, you know, no trespassing. We'll be shot on sight, I mean, all that stuff. And so we're like, how do we get it back in there?
Native people haven't had access to sites along the Great Redwood Trail because since they were forcibly relocated, the land has belonged to ranchers in the North Coast Railway Authority. How can tribes be expected to consult about the land when they haven't even been allowed to return to the land, is essentially what Merrifield is asking.
So the Great Redwood Trail comes in, they're like, hey people, you get to go back up in your territory again. Yay! No, that's not what we're asking, you know? And so the people that are up there, the Wildlife Conservancy, so now they're saying, hey, it's open to the public, and you tribal people can come too.
Two? Merrifield emphasized. She continued, quote, we haven't been out there in over 100 years. There were a lot of massacres up there. They herded hundreds of families, tribal members, to Round Valley, and they had the citizens' militia paid to hunt down tribal people, unquote.
at least know the history of why we're resistant on just opening that up to the public. I mean, there is a history that is not settled with our, with people, tribal people up there.
In an era where some federally recognized tribes have succeeded in large-scale land-back acquisitions, such as the recent 10,000 acres gained back by the Hoopa tribe, the Wailaki so far haven't gained much, except the 5 acres at Shelter Cove that they have entered into a co-management agreement to steward. Shannon Wilhite, board member and attorney for Native Health and Native Hands, argued in a separate interview on May 19th that, quote, every tribe has been traumatized by the European culture, but against the Wailaki tribe in particular, there were mass genocidal acts, unquote. She continued,
you know, doing this huge project of this trail that's going to go over, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of cultural sites, the places that they're wanting to protect from people who want to have recreation are places where their ancestors are buried. They were removed from their land and forced onto a reservation.
In the same vein, Merrifield continued,
you know, we are acclimated to this valley, you know, because this is like our home site now, you know. Some of them refer to it as a concentration camp because that's how they treated us when we first got here. So, you know, and our roll numbers, our ID numbers, you know, might as well tattoo that on us as well.
Merrifield went on, quote, my thoughts on the wild up there is leave the wild to the wild and leave it alone. I mean, you already took enough land, unquote. Merrifield additionally worries about the effect of the trail construction on the salmon runs. In an interview on May 21st, Eel River Wailaki historian Ben Schill concurred that, quote, the building of the railroad not only destroyed sites and cemeteries, but it dumped so much excavated material into the river that the huge salmon runs were terribly affected and remain a fraction of what they were, unquote. Perry Lincoln is the founding director of tribal nonprofit Native Health and Native Hands. He mused,
we're talking about where do we think about the porcupine? Do we think about the eel? Do we think about all those animals that are extinct that were in the river? So many shellfish, shell animals that were in the river are not even in the river anymore. And so all of this adds up to what we're talking about today. If we have a trail going up the Eel River Canyon corridor, is it going to cause more damage to life? Not just what we would like to see, oh yeah, I want to go hiking, blah, blah, blah. Is that really important when it comes to life in general? And that's where the Native person has always stood. That's what we were standing for. We were standing for all life.
Merrifield spoke to feeling pressured and rushed to review Great Redwood Trail documents.
They gave us, what, 30 days, 60 days to make comments on it? That's not right. It just feels like a lot of unfairness. You know, hurry up and read through that, and they gave us a deadline.
At the May 19th Kinestet Community Coalition meeting opposing the trail, Nicole Whipple, Round Valley Tribal member, Yuki descendant, and Save California Salmon representative for the Eel River region, concurred with Merrifield's sentiment about not having enough time to voice concerns. Quote, the state intentionally went ahead and when they did their planning, held the CEQA process over a period of time during a holiday season, so none of the tribal governments were in office or working, and the 30 days lapsed, and so some of the big tribes in the Sacramento Valley got left out. It's a tactic. It's what they do. So we definitely need to jump on that, otherwise we'll get pushed out the door, unquote. Whipple continued, quote, something to put in the comment is to talk about the fallacies they put in the master plan. We know they didn't reach out to this many tribal members. They didn't consult. They didn't reach out. Their numbers are false, unquote. Attorney Shannon Wilhite gestured to a page of the weighty draft master plan printed in full at the May 19th Kinestet Community Coalition meeting. She sighed, quote, there is a vision statement stating that they will work collaboratively with Native American tribes, and so far we haven't seen it. A huge fault is that they state that they have been working collaboratively, but there hasn't been any collaboration with most of the tribes, with the tribes that are opposing it or have issues with it, unquote. For KMUD News, I'm Serenity Wood.
please remember this is one viewpoint regarding the Great Redwood Trail. For more viewpoints, please visit the KMUD News SoundCloud page for additional reporting. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Kelly Lincoln, Matt LaFever, and Serenity Wood. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.